Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Alarm! Alarm! Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, of course. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to get HX231 across the Atlantic. Will we succeed in this episode?
I don't know, because it started off as two, went to three, now it's four.
I mean, there's every possibility that we never talk about anything else ever again. That it's just.
Well, I'll tell you something exciting, though, is I am talking to Ed Gretton this afternoon and his father, who are the son and grandson of Peter Gretton.
Amazing.
They've got in touch. They've heard it. They're pleased.
God, brilliant.
Don't feel we disgraced ourselves in the memory of their father, grandfather.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
So that'll be interesting. So I shall be reporting back on that front.
Fantastic.
And I think we'd got to the end of... Or we've got to the early hours, haven't we? The night of the 5th, 6th of April with Warunga.
Yes.
Starting to buckle.
So there have been 16 attempts to attack the convoy during the night, is what Gretton reports.
Yes.
But we're through to 5 o'clock in the morning, and I can't remember when dawn is, but it's probably a way off, isn't it? If we're, and after all, which clock are we on? Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, we got all that as well, haven't we? That's getting confusing. Plus
yes,
two.
It can't plus two or plus four, we don't know. Anyway, but Warunga has discovered that its main bulkheads are starting to buckle, so they have to abandon ship. Vidette screening.
Well, remember that Vidette is the destroyer.
It's the destroyer that can nip about. That's been probably the busiest ship of the lot because it's the fastest and the most heavily armed, isn't it? Basically,
thank God it refueled before it all kicked off.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a moment of simple sort of grace, isn't there, in this entire thing that they thought to refuel. But that is the Royal Navy. You refuel whenever you possibly can. If you can possibly refuel, you do. Which is, after all, one of the mistakes that Bismarck makes, isn't it, is they don't refuel.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Yeah. So Luftstreif, and remember, this is a corvette that the captain of which Gretton has a dim view.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel he's the weak link. But anyway, Luftstreif has gone off to help pick up survivors, as has the JR Poinsett, which is obviously one of the merchantmen. So that's interesting
that should be the case. I mean, maybe it's basically one of the quicker merchantmen, you know, because they're all the ships are of different capability. That you might be a fast convoy, but some might be quicker than others, and others might be slow. Or it's nearer, you know, it's the nearest. Yep. And they pick up 41 crew. 20 minutes later.
By the way, while we're talking about merchantmen, you know those HMSO sort of pamphlet books that they were produced in the war.
Yes.
They're sort of just a little bit bigger than A5, aren't they? And they've got a kind of, you know, they're always illustrated with fantastic maps and photographs and all the rest of it, and written by someone quite good. Well, anyway, lovely Nick Champion got in touch and said he had a spare copy of Merchantmen at War and would I like a copy? Well, actually, I have already got one. I've got quite a good collection of that. So I suggested that he send it to you. So
Brilliant. Oh, thank you. Thanks, Nick. That's very sweet of you. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah,
very excellent. Nice.
Anyway, yeah, I'll take that. Anyway, that was a minor rabbit hole.
But what this means, though, is that's 5 o'clock in the morning at 20 past five. Yep. So only 20 minutes after this all starts, this rescue of the Wurunga, U-134, which is still in contact with the convoy, attacks the Poinsett and Loosestrife and Wurunga with three torpedoes but misses. So
thank goodness.
So it's all still – it's all fingernails, isn't it? This whole thing is fingernails.
Yeah. So U-134, that means it should be one of the earlier ones.
Yeah.
You must have come across U-Boat.net.
No, I've not come across U-Boat.net.
U-Boat.net. So. Okay, it's got literally every single detail. So I've just put that into U-Boat.net. Okay.
Right.
So it was ordered on the 7th of August 1939. It was laid down on the 6th of September 1940. It was launched on the 17th of May 1941. And it's still going. Right. In the early part of 1943, so that's good going. Commissioned on the 26th of July 1941 by Kapitän Leutnant Rudolf Schendel.
Schendel, that's a sure.
Schendel, yeah. Kapitän Leutnant Rudolf. Schendel. But by this point, it's now. So he's in command till the 2nd of February 1943.
Yeah.
The 3rd of February 1943, a new Kapitän Leutnant takes over. Yep. Hans Gunther Brosen. He is now the commander.
Right.
He does 9 patrols, sinking 3 ships. That's not great, is it? Total tonnage, 12,147 tons.
That's not very much.
Yeah, it doesn't last much longer. Gets sunk on the 27th of August 1943 in the Bay of Biscay, north of Cape Ortegal.
Really?
In position 44.03 north, 080.05 west, by depth charges from the British frigate HMS Rover. So this is what you get. 48 dead, all hands lost.
Blimey.
So it's literally just off the north Spanish coast.
But as you kind of pointed out there, a captain or a commander, not that good at pressing things home because he's got three ships, one of which is sinking, and he can't hit that, and two ships coming in to help it, and he can't hit them. So perhaps a reflection that the Kriegsmarine hasn't got its best people on the job anymore because they're
interestingly, it doesn't list Lernhardt's. As one of the Wolfpacks it works with.
Right, that's interesting.
That's a little aside. But honestly, if anyone listening and you want to find out more, uboat.net is A1.
Excellent. Right, but the 6th, there's a big change.
Yes.
Which is the support group arrives from Iceland.
Da, 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 da. We're coming, boys.
Yes, yep. And this is under Commander A.G. West, support group commander on HMS Inglefield. It's Eclipse, Fury, and Icarus.
Icarus is very famous. I wrote about Icarus in my Battle of Britain book.
Did you?
Obviously, in the bit before the Battle of Britain.
It's before the Battle of Britain, obviously.
Because I was writing about it at Dunkirk, which, I decided to include in my Battle of Britain book.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So Icarus was at Dunkirk, and it was very much a sort of old 1930s kind of old-fashioned escort destroyers. So fleet escort destroyers rather than convoy escorts.
Bigger and slower.
They're still pretty good. They're just a bit kind of smokestacky, but they're still pretty good. There's not much wrong with them.
And incidentally,
do you know how many Royal Navy destroyers were sunk in the Second World War?
No, I don't, James, but you do.
I do. 132.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, just imagine what that looks like. 132 destroyers gone.
God, that's a lot.
I know, because I always used to think, you know, what would I do that would kind of give me a pretty good, you know, feel like you've done something, but not too dangerous, but you're kind of at the cutting edge. And I always kind of thought being in a destroyer would be great.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm not so sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also it's all incredibly hard work and relentless, isn't it? We'll get to this. But two of these ships have huffed off. So the ability to spot stuff has increased hugely because there's only been one Huffduff set in the escort group, isn't there?
So, yeah, and they're faster and better gunned. So, you know, they're bigger, faster, more upgunned. They've got two lots of Huff-Duff. You know, these are all destroyers. They might be 1930s destroyers, but they're still better than anything on offer on the current on B7 escort group.
And the air cover, more air cover, because they're getting that. Yes. They're a little bit closer to Iceland and everything's. It's not that it's getting easier. It's getting marginally less difficult. I mean, this is the thing. This is all still as we will. I mean, the next, you know, until 11 o'clock. So at 06:47, Tay chases a U-boat, U-270. But they track it with Asdic to 100 yards. They all see it clearly, and then it bugs off. 3 minutes later.
I mean, 100 yards is nothing. That's kind of a little over four cricket pitches.
Yeah. It's the other side of the street. I mean, well, the other yep. you know, the post yep. office from my front door. They depth charge, but only drop 5 rather than 10. So basically, there's then cat and mouse. And this is inside the convoy this is happening between the 7th and 8th.
Yes.
So the U-boats, you know, U-270, he knows what he's doing. He's getting in amongst it. But his problem is he's about to run out of cover of darkness. It's about, you know, daylight is coming. And at 8 o'clock, so an hour and 10 minutes later, a Liberator from 120 Squadron, Liberator E, arrives.
Yep.
And 2 minutes later drops a depth charge pattern, but U-270 gets away. But is interfered with, is stymied, which is the thing we were talking about last week. It's all about stopping the enemy from pressing home its attacks, basically making it difficult for him, as much as it is the destroying a submarine is a bonus. 0942, so Liberator E is sticking around. This is the point. 0942, it spots a U-boat shadowing the convoy. They drop 4 depth charges while the boat's still on the surface, submerges, reappears before diving. This is 594. And what does U-boat.net?
U-270 actually survives the war.
Really?
Manages to hit one ship in its entire career from being launched in July 1942.
Oh, dear.
It's decommissioned on the 25th of June 1944.
Oh, dear.
Laid up in a U-boat pen, later repaired and returned to service in August 1944. And then sunk. No, it doesn't survive. And then it sunk on the 13th of August.
All right. Okay. U-594.
Another not very successful one. Yeah.
U-594, which is one that's just been depth charged and damaged.
Yes.
U-594 sunk on the 5th of June 1943 in the North Atlantic west of Gibraltar in position 36.2 north, 1028 west by depth charges from a Hudson.
There you go.
All hands lost.
They all go. Yeah. Don't they? Yeah. I mean, that's the amazing thing.
Captain Lieutenant Dietrich Hoffmann at the time we're talking about. No, it's not. It's Friedrich Mumm who's taken over.
Friedrich Mumm, yeah. Kapitän Lieutenant Mumm.
Anyway, so 594 is damaged. There's water coming in the torpedo tank, one of the fuel tanks, and it had already been damaged by Videt. So it's interesting.
So Mumm thinks it's time to bug out.
Yeah, he thinks, all right, that'll do. You know, we've done our bit. You know, they can look everyone in the eye when they get back to Brest or wherever. 09:48, so 6 minutes later, Liberator T attacks a U-boat, U-592, which is crash dives and is damaged. And it's machine gunned the previous day. So that also, they sack it off. These crews are thinking, leave it ain't worth it. And also, these Liberators, they can stick around. And this is making all the difference. And the thing about, I mean, the point Gretton makes about the Liberators, it's a big aircraft, so it's not nippy. So if it sees a U-boat, the U-boat does have time to, if the U-boat crew alert, the U-boat does have time to get out of the way before you turn a four-engine bomb around.
You know, but by the same token, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about is just, it's not about destroying U-boats. It's about driving them away from the convoy.
Yeah.
And then you can crash dive, that's fine. But the moment you dive, you're not really in a position to attack anymore.
But what we have here also, and we didn't mention this, is the flying conditions are bad. So it's 10-10 cloud, 10-10 cloud, and a cloud base is 700 feet. So I imagine if you're in a U-boat and you're skulking along the top, having a look, suddenly a Liberator comes out of the cloud base and you're like, oh, shit.
Yes. How did it know we were here?
How did it know we were here? And you're not going to hear it because of your engines and all that sort of stuff until it's right upon you. So, you know, This is why they're crash diving, isn't it? Like, oh, God, you know.
Well, yes, and it's also gives you good reason to kind of, you know, not press your attack that hard, I would say.
Yes. Well, which is the thing we talked about, I think, in the first or second of this series, is that the crews at this point, the U-boat crews, they're pretty demoralised and they're lying about what they've been up to and saying, oh, no, we didn't, you know, they're being pretty ambivalent about pressing on their attacks. And you know, as I imagine I would be in this set of circumstances.
Yes, to be fair.
At 11 o'clock, U-270 surfaces, Inglefield and Eclipse. Inglefield being the from the support group. And Eclipse.
Yep.
So they're in the picture now. They hunt U-270 into the afternoon.
Although so basically, 270's got to be underwater the whole time. Exactly. Much of it.
So no huff.
And consequently, they don't get no more huff duff picked up at all until the last aircraft leaves at 19:35. So 7:35 p.m. I mean, which is just before darkness falls. It's now the beginning of April.
Air cover all day.
Well, these Liberators can fly for 16 hours, can't they?
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Been 16 hours airborne. Jesus.
Yeah. Vedette's back with a convoy. Lou Strife and JR Poinsett with the survivors of Warringah. And then they bring the stragglers back in. So it's all a lot more organised on the 6th, isn't it?
Mm.
So they're bringing the Aruba, Mossdale.
Well, they can have a bit of a sigh of relief, can't they? I mean, jeepers.
Yeah.
And these are stragglers. Exactly. These are stragglers who have not chosen to go away. These are stragglers because of mechanical issues or engine whatever or something they've had to stop to kind of repair things. And
7:12. U-632 fires a torpedo at Inglefield, but misses. At 1400 hours, U-706 sights a tanker, but the range is too great. You can read the crews going, that's too far away. It's too far away, boss.
Yeah, that's not bad.
There are Liberators everywhere.
Quite a lot of Liberators, all these extra destroyers, you know, better part of valor, live to fight another day.
And then 86 Squadron arrives to take over from.
Yeah, they're operating from Northern Ireland, remember?
Yeah. And then
we're getting closer.
And in the into the afternoon, 1618, U-boat picked up by radar by R, Liberator R of 86 Squadron, attacked with total surprise. Only one of four depth charge drops. The U-boat crash dives. Liberator R turned tightly and attacked again. Depth charge pretty accurate. Spaced for 90 feet, set shallow and drop. And they see they circle for 20 minutes and there's a large patch of oil. Scene. So
which is pretty kind of, you know, there's not much you can sort of argue with that. You can argue bubbles that the U-boats can release to sort of suggest that they're sinking.
Yes, that's
but
right.
But it's fake. But the oil, no. And this is the very same one that sunk the Blitar. Remember, is it the Danish one? Danish boat
or Norwegian?
Norwegian, yeah. I think. Yeah, U-6- they bugger off, don't they? They're the ones who leave the convoy early.
And this is U-632.
Mm-hmm.
And if you
first I'm, patrol,
oh my God!
I mean, they're just not good enough. They're not good enough for this.
Yeah.
Although they had sunk the Blitar,
two ships sunk, total of 15,255 tons. Yeah. All hands lost, 48. This is. I mean, what's interesting is that the first couple of days were sort of on balance okay for the U-boats. They were sinking stuff. There were people fleeing the convoy. The air cover hadn't added up. But what we're seeing here is when Allied provision works. The U-boats are—they're completely snooped.
Haven't got a chance, have they? Yeah. So if you can send a convoy over with 10 escorts rather than 6, and half of which are destroyers, you're in a much better position, aren't you?
And there's air cover literally all day.
Mm.
Anyway, U-632 is sunk. At dusk, there are still 8 U-boats shadowing the convoy, but there were 20. In the picket.
One's sunk, others have damaged, others have just given slipped up the away.
Decided discretion is the better part of valour. You know, this speaks to the point we're talking about. If you don't have to sink them, but if you can make them, I mean, the U-boats are at less than half, they're at 40% strength from the beginning of this encounter. That's no good if you're donuts, is it? That's the thing.
No. So another day has survived.
Yeah,
they've survived. There's no one sunk on that day on the 6th.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing because there's certainly going through the 5th, there's a feeling that it could go either way. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, and they are attacking on the 6th, but reading it back, looking across it, some of it feels a little half-hearted, which is, again, I get it.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing is you're getting the impression very clearly that the quality of U-boat command is just not as good. You know, I'm thinking about that U-boat that was stuck in the middle of the convoy, didn't fire.
Yeah, but
I mean,
also
it's just unthinkable in the preen era.
Yeah, but the stuff they've contend with, Preen never had to contend with air cover till 6:30, 7 at night, did he?
No, he didn't. You know, no, that is absolutely true.
It's not just, it's, you know, the circumstance, the Allies have succeeded in changing the rules of the game, basically. That's what's reflected here, as much as anything else. You know, Preen might have thought, you know, actually, this ain't worth it. We don't know, do we? So the next day, on the 7th, there's various sightings by aircraft of U-boats, but no further attacks, nor on the night of the 7th, the 8th, nor the 8th. Support group departs at dawn of the 8th of April. Job done.
Yes, and originally the support group is going to go on the 7th. It's just going to be there for 24 hours, but they get an extension. Well, you're being so effective. It's so important that we get this convoy in. So hang around for another 24 hours. So they do. So they don't leave until dawn of the 8th of April. And by this point, they're kind of home. You know, it is absolutely, they're into kind of, you know, they're nearing England, nearing Northern Ireland, and you know, they're kind of there. The 9th of... on the 9th afternoon, about 4 o'clock, 1600 hours, the local escort, so B7, the local escort arrives, takes over the safety of the convoy. And this is this really interesting bit. So this is the passage up, which is where I was doing my SPS paddle the other day. You know, past the Isle of Arran, Isle of Bute, and all the rest of it, and you go up the passageway that leads up to the Clyde and Greenock and Gurrook and all these places. It's Faz Lane, you know, it's where the nuclear submarines are based now. It's that kind of neck of the woods. And it was amazing to be out there on the water there and sort of, you know, imagining all these convoys coming in through this passage. But that's exactly where HX-231 goes through. And B-7s, their job is done. And the escort group, you know, heads up the River Foyle and goes back to base at Northern Ireland. Their work is over.
Yeah. And the local escort takes over at this point. Not that a U-boat isn't going to be trying to get in there anymore, is it? They're not going to...
No, exactly. Yeah. And Gretton makes an interesting point. He goes, the intricate machinery of the organization, which controlled the routing of merchant ships, now took over. Some ships would go straight to their destination. Some would immediately join coastal convoys. And some would wait at assembly anchorages for a convenient coastal convoy to take them to their eventual unloading port. So it's interesting, isn't it? You know, not all 61 sort of head up to the Clyde. No. You know, they have different destinations.
They're plugged into the next thing that they've got to do, yeah.
Yeah, and this goes back to the subject that John McManus and I were talking about the other day, which is, you know, who's organising all this? You know, every single ship has got a different cargo, and that cargo has an end point, and it's got to go somewhere, and there's a list with its name on, with its cargo on, and where its ultimate destinations are. But presumably it's got to go into another port, or it's got to be loaded onto lorries, or probably more likely trains, and distributed wherever, you know. But it's a process and a half.
They're not using Excel, are they?
They've got no spreadsheet.
No. Well, I mean, maybe there is a spreadsheet, but they're not using... It's not the way...
It's not courtesy of Microsoft.
No, exactly. So we'll take a break. We'll see you in a tick.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, Was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Caddy, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Convoy HX231, you will be relieved to hear, dear listener, has made it across the Atlantic despite our best efforts. I think we were more of a threat to it crossing the Atlantic than the U-boats were by the 6th of April, Jim.
Yeah, maybe.
Rabbit holing.
Yeah. It's possible.
So there's six ships lost, aren't there, on this convoy?
Yes, and I think it's really interesting of the ones that are lost. Only the Shillong, really. Shillong and the Warunga. Was it, which ones are hit in convoy? It's the Warunga, British Ardor, and Shillong, isn't it?
Yep.
So three are hit in convoy, and other three because they go off on their own, the fools.
Because they've gone off. So Vararen, which has gone off the Norwegian ship, everyone's lost, all hands lost. Tragedy. And you'd think if they'd stuck around, would that have been a different result?
Yeah, almost certainly, I'd have thought, so, yeah, I'd have said.
Yeah, I think so.
Because it's six out of 60.
British Ardor, all but one of the crew are picked up. Warunga, 19 men are lost when two of the lifeboats capsized and are damaged, including the captain. I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's terrible. So yeah, it's just awful, isn't it? I mean, you know, you got the lifeboat, you got out there, and then they capsize and... Oh. So the Blitar, as we mentioned, was hit by U-632 on its first one. There were 38 survivors from the number two boat. So all the lifeboats are numbered. Picked up on the 10th of April. Number six boat also picked up, so a total of 54 from Blitar rescue.
This terrible incident with Captain Kruger of U-631, where he says three boats get away safely, and while they're trying to pick the men out up from the water, submarines heard in the darkness, and the U-631, which didn't sink the Blitar, appears.
Yep.
And they go through the boats. They want to know who's on the boats. Number six boat, they talk to the... number six boat, but they're hidden under the men hide under the thwarts of the boat, and the submarine thinks the boat's empty. Then number two boat, Kruger says in English, where are the captain and the chief officer? But neither of them are wearing uniform, so they say, dunno. He says, come alongside or I shoot. Right?
Yeah.
And this is Gretton's account. And when the efforts to get the boat to the submarine failed owing to the seas, he shouted, row for your lives. I give you 5 or 10 minutes. Eventually, the U-boat ordered one of the men from number two boat to jump into the water and swim to the submarine. And Captain Knipp, who's the captain, still saying that he's only an able seaman, sets off and is hauled aboard the U-boat. On board, he refused to give any more information. The ship had some hides in her cargo. He continued to deny vehemently that he was an officer, and the Germans obtained remarkably little information from him. The U-boat then informed the boats that the man being released and Captain Knipp was pushed into the water. The wind and sea were so strong that the boats were unable to make any headway towards him. They had the agonizing experience of seeing the red light on his life jacket disappear and his shouts died away. There died a brave man.
Oh, just awful. I mean, talk about a lonely death, because he's going to know, isn't he? There's going to be a moment where he realizes he's lost. He's got no chance, and it's just a question of
And he goes
You've got to confront. Yeah. You've got to confront what happened to you.
Kruger excused himself by saying that the submarine had next to proceed to a secret rendezvous with a Milchkow tanker and that no prisoners were allowed on board during the operation of fueling. But he could easily have dropped Captain Knipp nearer to the boats and ensured that he was picked up. This is what Gretton says. His conduct deserved trial for crimes against humanity at Nuremberg, but he did not survive to face his accusers. It was a suitable retribution that U-631 was sunk by a member of B-7 group, the Sunflower, in October 1943. So there we go.
It's a terrible story, though, isn't it?
It's awful. Yeah. It's awful. And then the other two boats, then off they go, and they have Javanese and Chinese crew.
That's right.
Who die of exposure. They're determined to sail to Scotland.
This is still the Blitar.
The bravery of these men, the determination of these men. They're picked up by Canadian destroyer Restigouche. Number two boat, at least, are picked up by destroyer. And then number six boat are picked up by Eclipse, I think. They're spotted by a Flying Fortress and then picked up by Eclipse.
So 54 just, saved eventually.
Eventually, but just that story of the captain being thrown back in. Oh, it's awful, isn't it? It's horrendous.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely grim.
Yeah.
Then we've got the Sun Oil, which is the tanker, the American tanker. So that's hit by U-563 and finished off 7 hours later by U-530. And all hands lost. Every single one goes down. And obviously some of them did escape, but they weren't picked up.
Yeah.
So Vedette, if you remember, Vedette is sent off to go and try and find them and report seeing absolutely nothing. Yeah. So obviously they it's the middle of the Atlantic and they've just don't know what's happened to them. They've gone. Yeah. But again, another kind of sort of, agonizing, lonely death. Yeah. The Shillong, this is an amazing story.
Yeah.
So the Shillong, of a crew of 78, 33 are in one lifeboat and 24 on a raft. So most on the raft subsequently die. The raft capsizes three times. And do you remember we saw that picture, didn't we, of the raft? And it is literally like a, like those sort of shipping pallets you get. It's kind of like a giant one of those. It's absolutely hopeless. And by the morning, only five of the 24 are still alive. And they sight the lifeboat, the one lifeboat with 33 on, and manage to join them. And leading them is Cadet Moore, who's only 19. And in the lifeboat, there's 11 Brits and 28 Asians. And by the 10th of April, only 10 are still alive, 9 Brits and 1 Asian. And the theory about this is that the Brits, being Northern Europeans, are kind of better used to being exposed to cold weather and all the rest of it. I would also suggest that it's also that they're better fed.
Yes, and have been.
Got more
whole
fat
time.
On them than the Asians, who tend to be kind of, sort of skin and bones, really, don't they? And if you're kind of in the merchant navy, so they have got plenty of food, but they just don't have enough water. And by 10:30 a.m. on the 12th of April, they're finally spotted by a Catalina. They fire flares, and you then got the agonizing wait that you've been spotted, but you then got to wait to be picked up. And it's not until 5 o'clock 1700 that a Norwegian destroyer St. Albans, having already got the survivors of Blitar picked up, picks up these. Of the 10 alive, only 3 men fully recover, and all the rest have to have limbs amputated due to frostbite.
And an earlier
imagine?
On the night of the 5th and the 6th, the worst danger was from the large hatch covers floating near the boat, collisions with which would have shattered the boat. So Mr. McCrae, the third engineer, stations himself in the bows and spends the night fending off the hatch covers with a boat hook.
Amazing.
He never complained, but at dawn he was so exhausted that quietly and peacefully he laid down and died.
It's amazing. These stories of these lifeboats and the endurance these people have to go through. The thing is we all kind of sort of ooh and ah, don't we, about Shackleton and his journey and the incredible thing from Elephant Island to South Georgia.
Yeah, he wanted to go.
He does. But he kind of wanted to go. These guys are all sort of similar stories of incredible bravery and courage are happening every single day pretty much in the Atlantic, aren't they, during the war? And, most of them anonymous, forgotten about, never written about, and I think it's really important to stress that, we are just talking about one convoy, presumably the 231st.
On the XX route.
It's not the other. Or the other one.
Well, there is a question to be asked here. If you're a Javanese or Chinese sailor, obviously the merchant marine has always been full of people from all over the world since the year dot,
Since the Phoenicians, right?
Yeah, exactly. But what's motivating these guys?
Money.
Is it money? Is there enough money? But Jim, is there enough money for this?
Well, no, but yeah. There's got to be a reason why they're doing it. They're not doing it out of pride of
it's not king
joining
and
the
country.
British effort, are they?
No.
It's not king and country. It's definitely not.
Which is, I think, really interesting, isn't it? Because so often when we talk about, when you look at what motivates people in combat, and this is combat, let's make no mistake, right? Then you know, soldiers, we talk about the idea of you're looking out for your mates all the time as the thing that's keeping you going here. But if you're, like I say, if you're Chinese or Javanese or I don't know, an Egyptian or whoever on one of these ships, the pay can't be good enough. So you heads down won't happen to me. You know, what's your attitude? What keeps you turning up for work? Yeah. Aside from the fact you'll be in terrible trouble if you don't turn up for work. But do you know what I mean? These aren't pressed crews, are they?
I think it's absolutely incredible. It's just enormously hats off. And I just think because no one's really interested in the Merchant Navy, you know, they're so anonymous. You know, we talk a lot about kind of, you know, the forgotten campaign in Italy or the forgotten war in Burma or whatever. But actually, they get plenty of credit. And, you know, anyone who's remotely interested in the Second World War, sooner or later, they'll come around to Italy and to Burma, won't they? They just will, as a matter of course. But who looks into the Merchant Navy? Literally no one.
Anyway, thanks everyone for listening. We hope you've enjoyed getting HX231 home. We hope you've enjoyed our sort of ramblings and musings there. Although this is where the action is in the podcast sometimes. Although actually, it's been really brilliant to tell a single story and look at how it reflects what's happening at the time and the way it's running out in 1943. We're about to say goodbye to 1943, though, aren't we?
We are. We'll be on, we enter a new dawn.
Yeah,
can't wait. 1944, come on.
Yes, exactly. We will see you all soon. Thanks very much for listening. Cheerio.
Happy Christmas, everyone.
Yes, happy Christmas.